How do you make changes in your life? We'll talk today about two kinds of change in this episode of Recovery Support with Kevin Bergen. This is Recovery Support, and I'm Kevin Bergen, licensed psychotherapist. This show is to support those in recovery from sexually compulsive behavior and to offer that support with education, inspiration, and motivation. Patrick Carnes is one of the premier authorities today on sex addiction. We're going to look at some of his ideas about change from his book, In the Shadows of the Net, Breaking Free of Compulsive Online Sexual Behavior. First, we're going to read from the essay White Book, page 203, The Problem. Many of us felt inadequate, unworthy, alone, and afraid. Our insides never matched what we saw on the outsides of others. Early on, we came to feel disconnected from parents, from peers, from ourselves. We tuned out with fantasy and masturbation. We plugged in by drinking in the pictures, the images, and pursuing the objects of our fantasies. We lusted and wanted to be lusted after. We became true addicts. Sex with self, promiscuity, adultery, dependency relationships, and more fantasy. We got it through the eyes. We bought it, we sold it, we traded it, we gave it away. We were addicted to the intrigue, the tease, the forbidden. The only way we knew to be free of it was to do it. Please connect with me and make me whole, we cried with outstretched arms. Lusting after the big fix, we gave away our power to others. This produced guilt, self-hatred, remorse, emptiness, and pain, and we were driven ever inward, away from reality, away from love lost inside ourselves. Our habit made true intimacy impossible. We could never know real union with another because we were addicted to the unreal. We went for the chemistry, the connection that had the magic, because it bypassed intimacy and true union. Fantasy corrupted the real. Lust killed love. First addicts, then love cripples, we took from others to fill up what was lacking in ourselves. Conning ourselves time and again that the next time would save us, we were really losing our lives. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to talk today about different kinds of change, how we change our lives. We're going to read from Patrick Carnes' book, In the Shadows of the Net. And it's subtitled Breaking Free of Compulsive Online Sexual Behavior. Now, this is specifically about internet porn, but it's also applicable to any kind of sex addiction or any addiction at all. He was talking in a previous chapter about the concrete actions that people take to quickly stop some kind of a problem, to address specific consequences that that specific action is bringing on. He called that first-order change. This is a well-known psychological approach to change. There's first-order change, and there's second-order change. First-order change includes things that immediately stop a behavior, like putting a filter on your computer, or having a trusted friend who can look at your computer and look at your history. Now he's going to talk about second order change, and I start at the bottom of page 134 of his book. We will now introduce you to second order changes, those steps that you take to actually change the dynamics of your life and the way you live. The following chart shows the difference in attitudes during the first order and second order change processes and the requirements of each. First order change attitude is, I don't have to tell others. A second order change attitude is, there are no secrets. First order says, I can change behavior myself. Second order change, I'm powerless to change without the help of others. First order, I can always figure out or force a way to handle problems. Second order, sometimes there's events that I can't seem to control. First, I work best alone. Second, I need contact with and help of others. An attitude from first order change says, No one is hurt by what I do. Second order change attitude says, damage is rippled through the lives of the people I know. First order, I've not been hurt by what I've done. Second order, my behavior has disconnected me from myself. So you get the idea of how he's contrasting these attitudes between first order change and second order change. I continue here on page 135. First order attitudes are the stumbling blocks on the path to second order changes, and it's important to address them as you move toward making second order changes. Second order changes will set you on a path to long-term change. While your situation may feel quite hopeless or even desperate, and the struggle quite unwanted, those who have traveled this path before you have found that over time a completely new way of living can emerge. This new life, you will discover, will be well worth the pain and effort of the work you're in the midst of right now. Though it may be nearly impossible to imagine, you may eventually come to see this struggle as a treasured gift, one that has given you a new life that is more rich and fulfilling than you ever imagined possible. In making second-order changes, you'll find that deeper tasks emerge. The first-order changes of the previous chapter have enabled you to get a temporary handle on your problematic behavior. Now, you need to look at the deeper issues that a lifelong solution will require of you. Surely, more work and pain will be part of this journey, but if you commit to this process, you will not be disappointed with the result. Some aspects of recovery address basic developmental issues, and these issues take time to heal. How much time depends on each person? For some, it may be a year or two, while for others, it might be a lot longer. The process is not identical for everyone. Some people have great difficulty stopping their behavior. Be aware that there are critical factors that help the process and others that undermine it. Before we describe these factors, we'll first explore the six stages that people with compulsive or addictive behaviors go through as they succeed in their recovery. Now, Dr. Carnes talks about these six stages, and I'll just mention the stages without reading the details on each one. He talks first about the developing stage, figuring out where one is. The second stage is crisis and decision. This is trying to make a decision. Do I really want to change myself? The third stage is shock. This is the stage where one feels disoriented, almost numb, and just can't control the damage that has been going on. The next stage he talks about is grief. Grief is denial or bargaining. It's anger over the losses. It's acceptance of the reality of one's situation. And it certainly includes sadness. The next stage he talks about is repair, repairing some of the damage that has been wrought. And then the last stage he talks about is growth. This is actually growing and becoming a different person. I'm skipping over now to page 146 toward the bottom. He talks about coping and compartmentalization. When you've been keeping secrets, you become like a volcano. The part of yourself that is visible above ground is serene, calm, and beautiful, even majestic and unthreatening, like the cone of the volcano. Underneath the surface, invisible to others and to yourself, are all the experiences and feelings you've kept hidden for many years. Just as deep below ground, under the volcano, lies a mass of molten lava, heating and building pressure, month by month, year by year. By stuffing experiences into that barrier and out of sight, by keeping secrets, you've learned how to live a double life. This skill is known as compartmentalization. You've seen examples of compartmentalization in the lives of public figures, but perhaps have never put a name to these actions. Presidents, ministers, politicians, and others create a public persona, a self that they show to the world, but too often there's another side, a shadow side, and occasionally that shadow side is revealed to the world when news of sexual misconduct or financial misdealings, for example, splashes across the media and into our lives. These people have used compartmentalization to deal with the duality of their lives. Can you begin to see how secrecy, compartmentalization, and the private hidden world of cybersex are all connected? Over time, all the thoughts and experiences and feelings that you put into the core begin to build up, and the older you are, of course, the more stuff you've buried. Deep under that volcanic peak, enormous pressures have been building for many years. Eventually, enough pressure builds up that an explosion or a flip occurs, and some of that hidden stuff is thrown out into the world. It may take the form of a violent crime, using alcohol or other drugs, or the compulsive use of cybersex. This acting out is a way to relieve the pressure that's built up in your core. At the moment when the flip occurs, you also reveal your true self, your soul. That soul, however, is completely encrusted by all the garbage that you've piled on it for so long, while the person you consider yourself to be, that buffed, kind, moral person, is not there on the other side. But the flip doesn't last long. Soon you flip back, denying to yourself and others what you've done. We call this a truthful lie. A person may deny having been drunk at the office party, or having molested a child, or having had sex with someone he or she met via the internet. Because the part of us that we identify with, the ego on top, couldn't have done those acts, we deny them. Unconsciously, we tell ourselves that it was the part of us we don't identify with that did them, and that is the truthful lie. Compulsive and addictive behaviors are a sure sign that there is a major barrier between the ego and the inner self, and that we're feeling a great deal of pressure and stress. We're desperate for a way to relieve some of that pressure, and the three quickest ways to get some relief are sex, alcohol, and other drugs. We're trying to find a way to open ourselves up, and for a brief moment, these seem to do the trick. Other compulsive behaviors, such as gambling and overeating, may also seem to serve this purpose. But the relief is only temporary, very temporary. We feel alive and free, but before we know it, we crash. Eventually, the pressure builds up and again we act out. Soon we're in the midst of a cycle of compulsive addictive behavior, one we return to over and over because we don't see any other option. In this state, we're living in the extremes, not in the convergent zone of the soul. Research has shown that people who have lived with a great deal of anxiety or fear, stemming from dysfunctional families, child abuse, sexual assault, trauma, or other causes, can actually experience an alteration of the brain that causes them to process information in the extremes. They tend to see life in terms of all or nothing, black or white, all one way or all the other. And when they turn to alcohol, other drugs, food, or sex, for example, to relieve the pressure and to fill the void they feel, they go to the extreme. They do not know that any middle way exists, that it's possible to have appropriate boundaries or to control their impulses. They stay in the extreme, extreme sex, extreme drinking, overeating, and so on. Maybe, for example, they've been sexually abused as a child, and one of two things happens when they grow up. They either act out sexually or shut down sexually. Likewise, individuals who've experienced violence when they were children will, without help, either become victims or perpetrators of violence. Other people find themselves caught up in binge-purge cycles. They'll binge on something such as alcohol or food, and then go to the opposite extreme by trying to purge this behavior from their lives. They'll act out sexually, and then decide to become celibate. In either case, These people don't know how to live a balanced life. The answer to this predicament isn't just to go to the opposite extreme. Abstinence, for example, is not the answer to the problematic sexual behavior. Likewise, the answer is not, as too many people initially assume, to make the barrier even stronger. Doing so may seem to work, but if you take this course, you're actually just creating a very large pressure cooker that'll eventually explode. Your next flip, and there will be a next one, will be even more dramatic with even greater negative consequences. All the stuff you've been trying to hide will come out despite your best efforts to hide it. The task of recovery is essentially to dismantle the barrier you've created over the years and to reconnect with your shadow side and with your soul. Once you start to take down that barrier, you'll have to address all the issues and experiences and consequences that you've stuffed inside. With this opening comes pain and grief. This is also the most likely point at which you'll relapse and turn back to your old behaviors. It's exactly for this reason that we have urged you to put your first order changes in place. Having a support group, a therapist, boundaries for your computer use, and so forth will also help you get through this difficult time with less chance of a major relapse. If you do relapse, it's not the end of the world. Others too have relapsed. This doesn't mean you can't recover or that you should give up. It's just part of the process. At this point in recovery, it's easy to focus on the ability to become abstinent and to control your sexual behaviors. The real challenge, however, is to learn how to approach and work with deeper personal issues. It's about learning to deal with what Carl Jung called the shadow self. It's not really the internet or cyber sex that's been casting a shadow over you. Rather, it's that you've been in the shadow of yourself. Once the barrier is down, you will start on a journey that will help you expose your shadow self and see who you really are. People who have been in recovery for a long time will tell you that one of the easiest tasks in recovery is abstaining from the problematic or addictive behavior. The more difficult task is to look at your relationships with other people and your relationship with yourself and to explore your life, past and present. You'll begin to move toward the center, what we call the recovery zone. When there's no longer a barrier between the parts of yourself, you can begin to develop an ongoing connection with your core, with your soul. With the barrier gone, your creativity and passion can flow throughout your life. Your life can become a reflection of the beauty of your inner self. You experience continual growth and expansion. You are living in the zone of the convergence of the soul. I'm going to conclude the reading today from Patrick Carn's book, In the Shadows of the Net, and we're going to pick it up again there next week. There's a lot of data that I've shared with you today, and I want to give you a chance to soak that up. I recommend that you maybe get a copy of this book, In the Shadows of the Net, by Patrick Carnes, David L. Delmonico, and Elizabeth Griffin. There's much more in the book than I can cover in this brief podcast. We're going to read now from the essay White Book, The Solution, on page 204. We saw that our problem was threefold: physical, emotional, and spiritual. Healing had to come about in all three. The crucial change in attitude began when we admitted we were powerless, that our habit had us whipped. We came to meetings and withdrew from our habit. For some, this meant no sex with themselves or others, including not getting into relationships. For others, it also meant drying out and not having sex with the spouse for a time to recover from lust. We discovered that we could stop, that not feeding the hunger didn't kill us, that sex was indeed optional. There was hope for freedom, and we began to feel alive. Encouraged to continue, we turned more and more away from our isolating obsession with sex and self and turned to God and others. All this was scary. We couldn't see the path ahead, except that others had gone that way before. Each new step of surrender felt it would be off the edge into oblivion, but we took it. And instead of killing us, surrender was killing the obsession. We had stepped into the light, into a whole new way of life. The fellowship gave us monitoring and support to keep us from being overwhelmed, a safe haven where we could finally face ourselves. Instead of covering our feelings with compulsive sex, we began exposing the roots of our spiritual emptiness and hunger, and the healing began. As we faced our defects, we became willing to change. Surrendering them broke the power they had over us. We began to be more comfortable with ourselves and others for the first time without our drug. Forgiving all who had injured us, and without injuring others, we tried to right our own wrongs. At each amends, more of the dreadful load of guilt dropped from our shoulders until we could lift our heads, look the world in the eye, and stand free. We began practicing a positive sobriety, taking the actions of love to improve our relations with others. We were learning how to give, and the measure we gave was the measure we got back. We were finding that none of the substitutes had ever supplied. We were making the real connection. We were home. And in closing today, I'm going to offer the third step prayer, which you can find by Googling third step prayer, or look on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, or on page 95 of the SA White Book. If you know the prayer, please join me. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. The Recovery Support Podcast doesn't promote any program or fellowship, and it only informs about resources that I've found helpful to my clients. You can refer to the show notes at recoverysupport.podbean.com. And if you have any questions or any kind of feedback for me, I welcome it at kbrecoverysupport@gmail.com. Have a terrific week and have a sober day.